Okay, please be seated, everyone, and we'll call our next case, which is case number 62606, First Financial Bank versus Lane et al. We have Ms. Reinhardt on behalf of the appellant and Mr. Kishan on behalf of the respondents. Okay, Ms. Reinhardt, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Leslie Brian Hart. I'm with the law firm of Lionel Sawyer and Collins.
Excuse me one second. Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
We represent First Financial Bank. In this case, you will have an opportunity to decide the meaning of NRS 40.451. This case presents a legal issue as to the meaning of the final sentence of that statute, a sentence that reads, such amount constituting a lien is limited to the amount of the consideration paid by the lien holder. First Financial Bank urges this court to adopt an interpretation of this sentence as the 1969 legislature intended, as imposing a limit on the indebtedness, the amount extended to the borrower by the lien holder or on the borrower's behalf. Said differently, how much consideration was paid for the loan, not as imposing a limit on the amount a successor lien holder can recover based on the amount the successor lien holder paid for the loan. Respondents urge this court to make new law by interpreting this sentence in a manner that is inconsistent with 40 plus years of history in this state. Commercial lending, upon which the economic foundations of our economy are based, and would also render the 2011 legislature's adoption of NRS 40.451C virtually meaningless. For over 40 years, NRS 40.451 was not challenged by borrowers or guarantors in an effort to impose a limit on the amount of a deficiency judgment an assignee of a loan could obtain. The economic foundations of commercial lending in this state and the tremendous economic growth that we've enjoyed for most of the last 40 years have occurred within the framework of this statute. And lenders and borrowers in this state have relied on this interpretation in negotiating their commercial documents for decades. No guarantor or borrower has challenged this interpretation until just recently, in the wake of the economic crisis that we faced and the Nevada legislature's attempt to address the economic crisis by, among other things, adopting legislation such as NRS 40.491C. NRS 40.451 is clear and has been interpreted by lenders and borrowers for over 40 years in a manner that's consistent with what FFB urges the court to adopt today. There is a second equally compelling reason why this court should adopt the interpretation urged by First Financial Bank. FFB's interpretation of NRS 40.451 gives meaning and effect to the legislature's implementation of AB 273, codified at NRS 40.451C. If the respondent's interpretation is accepted by this court, it would render that legislative act virtually meaningless. We know that the legislature would not undertake to do an act that is rendered meaningless. It is illogical and contrary to principles of statutory construction that the legislature would engage in that act and develop an entirely new statutory scheme that we call AB 273 if NRS 40.451 means what respondents urge that it means.
Ms. Reinhardt, do you feel that our recent case of Lavey versus District Court as it pertains to 40.459 has any interplay in this case at all?
I don't. It's clear after Sandpoint that 40.4591C does not apply to this case, and at least not directly. I think the respondents have conceded that, so this case now turns entirely, in my view, on how this court will interpret NRS 40.451.
Thank you.
If this court accepts the respondent's interpretation of that statute, it would mean that 4451, which already imposes, under their interpretation, a factor that considers the amount the successor lien holder paid to acquire the loan as a factor in determining the amount of the indebtedness. That is the concept that the Nevada legislature implemented through AB 273, and the legislative act in 2011 would have been largely unnecessary if this court is to accept the respondent's interpretation of NRS 40.451.
Would your reading of 40.451 require revision of some of the language in Sandpoint?
Your Honor, there are, of course, comments in Sandpoint that are instructive as to what the court was thinking at the time it considered the case before it, which, of course, is a case that was largely focused on the retroactive impact of 40.4591C. What we think this case gives all of you an opportunity to do is to look at that statute in isolation and in the context of these facts and determine, based on this issue alone and no other, whether the legislature's adoption of NRS 40.451 in 1969 intended to have any impact on.
Because it does seem to me you have to say that some of the language in Sandpoint should not be read literally in order to credit your position, but by the same token, I don't know how you would have had an issue in Sandpoint unless you're correct on your reading of 451, because 451 and 459 would be essentially the same if they were limiting to successor liability.
That's right, and I do think the court would certainly need to look back at that language, and perhaps a decision in this case that accepts the interpretation that we urge would be a slight modification of what I think is dicta in the case of Sandpoint.
And would you say that's addressing dictum rather than actual holding in Sandpoint, or are you saying that we need to overrule Sandpoint?
I do not believe you need to overrule Sandpoint. I think that is dictum because, in my view, it was not necessary to the outcome the court reached in that case, which was, of course, the retroactivity of that statute.
Right, that was the focus of it.
And in fact, if what may need clarification or could be construed as needing clarification out of Sandpoint is, in fact, just dicta, and the facts of this case allow us to be more pointed with respect to the subsections of the statute, do we even need to revisit or clarify Sandpoint?
I don't think you do. I think the outcome that you reach in this case, if you accept the interpretation that we are urging you to accept, I think will stand on its own as you reflect upon that specific sentence of the statute and how it relates to this case.
But you do acknowledge that there may be some internal inconsistency with respect to what Sandpoint purports to say, albeit dicta.
I do. I see that, Your Honor.
Should we take into consideration the fact that this case is slightly different from Sandpoint, that we have potential of the federal preemption under the Financial Institution Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act? And does that have any application to the guarantors?
Your Honor, you did raise in our brief that if the interpretation that the respondents urge is accepted by this court, we believe that interpretation is preempted by federal law. We cite the interim finance case, a decision from the federal court by Judge Dawson, in which the judge in that case explains all of the policy reasons why that federal law would preempt the interpretation that the respondents are urging in this case. It's our view that you don't need to reach the preemption argument because in our interpretation of the statute, the one that we urge the court to accept, it doesn't in any way impact the successor's ability to recover the full amount that was extended to the borrower, and it's only if you reach a contrary result, in my view, that you would need to address the preemption argument.
Do you agree with the Herr case and its interpretation of 451?
In that case, as I recall it, Justice Pickering, the court focused on, I believe it was Category 6, a catch-all of NRS 4451, and that the final sentence was really modifying just
the sixth clause.
I think the better approach, in my view, is that final sentence of NRS 4451 should be read to interpret the entire or to provide guidance on the entire, all of the categories that are
identified. So each of the enumerated categories in the first sentence, you would say the second sentence captures all of those and requires actual advances or consideration to have been provided to the mortgagor.
That's my interpretation.
Rather than the sixth. I mean, either one grammatically works.
Right. I think using the final sentence of NRS 4451 as an explanation or a limit on all of the categories is really more reflective of the legislative intent from 1969, in which I think the legislature made it clear that what they were trying to do was prevent lien holders from recovering anything more than what was actually extended either directly to the borrowers or on behalf of the borrowers. For example, in those kinds of situations in which a line of credit was authorized or a loan was going to be funded in tranches, of course the creditor would not be entitled to recover anything more than what was directly extended to the borrower. I think that's
it doesn't what, matter to the outcome in this case, though, right?
I agree. The interpretation that we urge is not only consistent with the clear language of the statute, it's consistent with the legislative intent in 1969, but it also does allow the court to avoid absurd results. For example, in a situation in which there's been an intrafamily transfer or a probate proceeding in which somebody is receives the benefit of a note and a deed of trust for no consideration under the respondent's interpretation, that would be a case in which that family member or heir would be unable to recover a deficiency if the interpretation that they urge is accepted, because there would have been no consideration paid by the heir or the family member for the transfer. That would also create an unintended and potentially absurd result in a case in which there have been additional tranches of a loan funded after the time the loan was transferred. For example, two tranches, perhaps totaling $6 million, funded before the transfer. A transfer occurs, the successor lender funds two additional tranches, and under the respondent's interpretation of the statute, the successor lender or lien holder would not be entitled to recover for those tranches funded after the transfer occurred, which, of course, would create an unintended result and would, in fact, I think, chill commercial lending in the state. And I've got some additional time I'd like to reserve for my rebuttal.
You may do so.
Thank you.
Counsel?
The Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Saeed Kashani. I represent John C. Serpa, Sr. and Mr. and Mrs. Lane on this appeal, who are respectively guarantors and borrowers under the underlying instrument. We ask this Court to confirm its clear interpretation of 40.451 as set out in the Sandpoint decision. We feel that this was a very clear reading of a fairly clear statute as set out in Sandpoint. We only ask the Court to clarify that its interpretation of 40.451 also applies to guarantors, and that is again based on the clear wording of the statute, specifically 40.465. Let me start with 40.451. It is suggested that the last sentence of 40.451 essentially is surplusage, that it adds nothing to the meaning of the statute. This is the interpretation advanced by the purchaser of the instrument in question here, not the lender. They were not the lender. The interpretation is that the last sentence simply confirms or has something to do with the fact that of what has been advanced by the original lender or the successor. If that is the case, I ask two questions. First, why then is that last sentence missing from NRS 40.465? 40.465 contains more or less the same interpretation of indebtedness, goes through the various categories, principal balance of the obligation together with interest, costs, fees, and advances, other amounts secured by the mortgage or lien upon real property. This is the definition of indebtedness in 40.465. The definition of indebtedness in 40.451 is the same in the first sentence, in the first part, but then there is an additional sentence, which is such amount constituting a lien is limited to the amount of the consideration paid by the lien holder. Why is that extra sentence there? How can it be reconciled with the lack of that sentence in 40.465? The fundamental principle of statutory construction is that this court should give meaning to all of the phrases of the statute and create harmony among the parts. If we are to follow the purchaser's interpretation, then that sentence is just surplus. It's just repeating what was said before. But if we are to interpret the statutes consistently, we must conclude that the last sentence of 40.451 provides some additional meaning. And that additional meaning is set forth clearly in this court's Sandpoint decision, which is that, quote, it limits the lien amount, and the lien amount is one factor among several in determining the total amount of indebtedness, which is then applied in NRS 40.451 to determine the deficiency judgment. And this as well explains the claimed contradiction between 40.451 and the amendments to 40.459, which is, as this court held in Sandpoint, 40.451 in the last sentence limits one component of the calculation of indebtedness. It does not limit the total judgment. AB 273 limits the total judgment. These are two different things. 40.451, one component. 40.459, total judgment. This is how the difference is reconciled. This is the only interpretation that gives meaning to all of the statutory language in all of the statute. We really have to consider Title 40, Chapter 40, as a whole. And when we take it as a whole, we see a clear understanding that this additional language applies to calculation of indebtedness in 40.451, and a different language applies, as the court noted, under 40.465. This is the only way to reconcile the
We certainly understand your argument, but from a practical standpoint, why would a lender here, in this case a successor lender, ever buy a loan at a discount if they could only recover the discounted amount that they paid for it? Why would they do that? It makes no economic sense to do that.
Well, first of all, this legislature has already spoken to that in passing AB 273. Going forward, every, let me call them speculator, in discounted instruments will encounter that issue. Mm-hmm. Going backwards, the statute as written applied at the time. Any lender, any purchaser could have read the statute at the time. But in answer to the court's question, the buyer is still entitled to recover interest on what it paid. So there are additional value that it can recover. It can still recover the value of the property, the full value of the property, even if the property exceeds the value of what it paid for the note. It can still recover the value. That's not a limitation. So they can still profit on the deal. What this legislation does, and I think what it was intended to do, to the extent the legislature even thought about speculation and instruments, which really was not an issue in 1969, what it does is what's been the consistent rule as presented by this court since 1865, which is when you lend on real property, look to the real property for the value and the return on that loan. Yes, the guarantee can provide some additional security, but look first to the real property. Don't speculate in guarantees. Or as the legislature noted in AB 273, we do not want guarantees to become a profit center. I submit that it discourages improper lending to require the banks to look to the collateral, look at the value of the collateral, and don't think that there's some guarantor out there that's going to bail you out of this situation. Particularly because, as we see in this situation, as we know from experience, and in this case, 9 times out of 10, the so-called guarantor has an interest in the actual property being lent against. So what is the additional value actually being provided by that guarantor? Is it really a separate guarantor? It seems to me in most cases it is not. It's simply the owner of the LLC borrower, some relationship to the land itself, which means that the net value, the balance sheet of the guarantor is more or less the same project that you're lending against. So what does it add to have the guarantee in the first place? Secondarily, I would add, this argument advanced by the lenders that interpretations will dry up lending in the state or discourage lending. This argument is advanced in the legislature every time one of these issues came up. After this court issued the Shields decision, which extended deficiency protection to the guarantors, the legislature, the next year, the next session, 1987, was faced with a proposed bill by the banking lobby to rescind the Shields decision and make guarantor and remove the protections for guarantors. The Chief Justice of this court, Chief Justice Gunderson, went to the legislature and presented a memo from this court explaining the rationale behind the Shields decision, why it was necessary, why it protected not only the guarantor but the borrower, discouraged speculation, prevented double recovery, prevented manipulation of sources of recovery, prevented underbidding. And the legislature, on the other hand, the banking lobby, once again, came and said, if you don't pass this law, if you don't rescind the Shields decision, lending will dry up in the state. Well, guess what? The legislature did not pass the banking lobby's provision in 1987, and there followed, within 20 years, the greatest period of lending the state has ever seen.
But they did modify, in 1987, the Shields decision to some degree, didn't they?
There was, but they did not remove the deficiency protection for guarantors.
Counsel, that's that deficiency protection. What are we to do with the federal preemption, though?
In this case, I submit that the federal preemption does not apply because we are not asking for a change in the statute. 40.451, as construed by this court in Sandpoint, existed.
But the preemption does a certain thing in terms of how it looks at this. It does not allow, in essence, it is different from the application of 451. It says, this is what the original person paid. You've assumed that because it's under this special receivership, it stays consistent. Why should we just not look at that? Is the guarantor outside of that scope, or does it fall within it? Because Sandpoint really didn't touch that particular issue because that wasn't before the court in Sandpoint.
Well, I submit that the record has not been completely developed in this case either. I mean, the factual, this case started with a motion for judgment on the pleadings that was denied by the lower court. And one of the objections that we raised to this question, to the motion for judgment on the pleadings, which we raised in our opposition at...
Counsel, I guess my concern is if I follow your logic and don't take into consideration possibility of federal preemption and how that would interact, I would come up possibly with a result that's not correct under the circumstances.
But it's never been held that FIREA or any of the federal statutes preempt state law of deficiency and state law of foreclosure. There's no uniform federal law of foreclosure. Rather, each state has its own law.
I understand the foreclosure aspect of it, but the protection it attempts to give in the assuming of failed banks, loan packages and things of that nature.
But when the bank made that loan, 40.451 was in effect, and it was, the reading of the statute was the same as
I guess if I follow your logic, you're telling me state law is superior to the federal law, and that's, I guess, the ultimate concern I have.
What I would say is that when there's no federal law that says we apply a federal law that determines the amount of money that a guarantor or borrower must pay under a loan secured by real property. Rather, the state law governs that. And I don't think that the preemption might apply to a question of new statutory, of a new legislation that is attempting to reach back and govern loans that were made before the legislation was passed. The preemption issue is better directed to AB 273. And there may come a day when that preemption issue is applied to AB 373. But when the loan, whether it be a federal deposit institution or any bank, when they made the loan, 40.451 was in place as currently written. Simply a matter of interpretation.
But as you read it, you'd be penalizing the free assignability of that note, and that's precisely what FIREA says you can't do.
Well, but AB 273 has done the same thing.
I understand that, and that brings me to my next point, which is you say that the last sentence has to be read as you would of 451 because otherwise it's just surplusage. But let's take that one more step. Let's read 451 as you do. Then what does 459.1c bring to the party? It would be complete surplusage to your reading of 451, right?
But not as this court interpreted in Sandpoint, because for the amended 459 imposes a limitation on the total judgment, not simply on one component. Because you could definitely have a case.
Well, tell me why that matters.
Because under 40.451, you could definitely have a case, and you will have a case in this case upon remand, where the purchaser of the note will recover more than he paid for the note. Because under 40.451, they will recover what they paid for the note, interest thereon, costs, and so forth. Whereas under, and that will exceed what they paid for the note. Whereas under 459, as amended by the legislature, their total judgment is limited to what they paid for the note. And therein lies the difference.
So even if they, you're saying 459 would restrict them from the cost of foreclosure sale, they can't get that either, even though they're incurred post-acquisition?
I believe so. Under AB 273, their total judgment is limited to what they paid for the note, which is not the case under 40.451. One component is limited. It's, in a sense, it's not a limitation, it's a reset. You reset the principal balance of the loan to what they paid to purchase that instrument, and then you start running up interest and all these other charges on top of that. So they will get a return on what they pay. And addressing the federal issue, this will not discourage, I think it will discourage improper speculation in instruments, but it will not deprive the purchaser of an instrument from his return. Because after they purchase, it will continue to accrue interest from the date of that purchase until they...
But you're still penalizing the acquisition, which was FIREA steps in, it's a receiver. You have only 1 minute left, and neither of you has addressed the guarantor issue and the disconnect between the stipulation and the contract language with respect to how that limit in the guarantee works. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes. First of all, I would just say that it's in our brief that we think the 40.451 also should apply to guarantors, and this is, I think, required. This is the only point of Sandpoint that we suggest requires clarification. If we follow the statutory language of 40.465, it applies a different definition of indebtedness for those limited cases where the guarantor is doing subrogation. As far as the factual issue, we suggest, as we put in a brief, that this is requires more factual development. Again, this case came up on an entry of judgment by the purchaser of the note. They brought a motion for judgment of the pleadings. It was denied. We respond to that motion by pointing out that the motion was based on facts outside the record. The court denied the motion based on AB 273, but he did not enter judgment in favor of one party or the other. The case required further factual development, and one of the factual developments is the effect of the actual wording of the guarantee and the limitation. And we think that this is something that is more appropriate for the lower court to develop through deposition, discovery, and so forth, rather than for this court to reach into an incomplete factual record that was based on a judgment on the pleadings and then make a determination on that basis.
So you think the guarantee language is ambiguous and is going to require more than a construction of its wording?
Well, if you put it that way, no, we don't. But we think that the bank should not be deprived of the opportunity necessarily to address that. Okay. But we think the guarantee language covers the first $1.5 million. The stipulation covers the first $1.5 million, and that has been recovered under any definition.
So the 2.3 takes it out?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I ask one proceeding? Now, the foreclosure sale, and this took place in March of 2011, is that correct? The trustee's sale on this property?
March of 2000, yes, it took place before the effective date of April.
And when was the complaint filed by First Financial?
April 19, 2011.
Okay, so it was within a month or so of the trustee's sale.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay, it was timely filed, if that's Your Honor's question.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Well, I didn't see that as an issue in the case. I just wanted to make sure. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. And Ms. Beinhart, you have, 3:29, about 3.5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd first like to address Justice Douglas's question about preemption. And I think counsel's argument conflates the preemption analysis with the retroactivity analysis. I agree with what Justice Douglas was questioning counsel about. You don't avoid the preemption analysis simply because this is not a new statute that's been in effect for 40 years. To the extent this statute would be applied in a novel manner that would raise the preemption issue, it is an issue that the court should address in the event the court accepts the respondent's interpretation of the statute. I'd like to then address Justice Pickering's comments about the potential surplusage of AB 273 if this court accepts the argument that respondents urge. And as Justice Pickering was suggesting, the entire statutory scheme that was implemented by AB 273 would be rendered virtually meaningless. And we know that's not the case because that statutory scheme generated considerable litigation, considerable controversy, and the legislative history that was reflected by Assemblyman Conklin's comments, as well as reiterated by this court in the Sandpoint decision, indicate that that really amounted to what I think is a sea change in the way assignees were able to collect the amount that was loaned to borrowers. It doesn't allow the assignees to obtain a windfall. In fact, the contrary interpretation would allow borrowers to have a windfall because they would have been precluded or they would not be required to return the money that they actually received from the lenders in these instances. And the final comment I'd like to make with respect to the guarantor issue, the argument raised for the first time in an answering brief filed before this court is that Mr. Serpa's guarantee only extends to roughly the first $1.7 million of the loan. As we explained in our reply brief, if that were the case, Mr. Serpa would have insisted on a dismissal of this case long ago because we stipulated, including a stipulation that was signed by his counsel on his behalf, that the value of the property in this case was to be $2.3 million. All of the facts that he needed to make the argument that he makes here before the court today were in place many, many, many months ago. The issue was not raised before the district court. Discovery is closed on that case. You have all of the information that you need in the record before you to decide that the guarantee should be interpreted as a guarantee that allows FFB to recover from Mr. Serpa himself up to $1.7 million, not as Mr. Serpa only be required to cover from precluding us from recovering anything at all because the property value itself exceeded what he agreed to pay in his guarantee.
Chief, I have a question.
Justice Harris, Chief.
Yes, counsel. First, I appreciated seeing this case and reading the words of the great Edward Everett Hale, which offers a tremendous amount of history for this section. I could just hear him speaking the words that are reflected in this legislative history, including the concerns around the final sentence that's in dispute here. Mr. Hale's explanation of why it was there isn't very clear to me. I'm not sure it was very clear to him, which makes it difficult to understand how it would be interpreted now. I wondered if you could comment on his explanation for the role that the sentence played in this statute and to which subsection or sections it would apply in the real world or in the practical sense.
Sure, I'll try and do that briefly. I see that I'm out of time. May I have a few additional minutes to respond?
Of course, you always can answer Justice's question.
With respect to the legislative history from 1969, certainly there are parts of it that are difficult to understand, but I think what is clear when you read that legislative history as a whole is what the legislature was trying to do was to prevent lenders, as it should have done, from recovering anything more than what they extended, as I explained in my opening argument, anything more than they extended to the borrowers.
What about the discussion on sold out junior lien holders, which seemed to have animated a lot of the legislative history? It was a pre-Carrillo, if that's how you say that case name, where it was up in the air whether we were going to follow California. But it's not clear to me how that last sentence would have exactly worked to fix that problem of a lender trying to circumvent the anti-deficiency statutes by taking some kind of junior position, and as Hale himself said, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But he seemed to be addressing that last sentence to that concept. Do you have any light to shed on that discussion?
Your Honor, unfortunately, I don't. I have struggled with that legislative history as well and tried to make sense of that, and I'm not able to offer you any additional insight on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you for bringing this case to us. It's a very interesting case, and we appreciate all the excellent arguments and briefing in the case, and the case will be taken under submission.